morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Donald Trump has just recently said the words he will be most infamous for, and which might well ring the doom of democracy in the USA. He said, quote, "A lot of people are saying, maybe we would like a dictator," unquote. A recent letter writer to the Washington Post newspaper called Trump the orange blob, quote, unquote. A remark about his hair, of course. Perhaps orange fruitcake might also be appropriately descriptive. Yellow-domed cretin has been heard among Americans in relation to Trump's ambitions toward despotism, as well as to his cowardly draft dodging of the Vietnam War, which has given him a descriptive sobriquet of President Bonespurs. It virtually seems a contradiction that our wartime draft-dodging president insists upon returning the Defense Department to its old Spartan spear-rattling designation of War Department, and not least, burning Old Glory is once again a crime, yet politically defecating on it, as Donald Trump does consistently to further his criminally despotic intentions, is lawful, even purportedly patriotic. So, in these grim days of so-called patriotic despotism, burning the flag is no longer to be considered, quote, symbolic free speech, unquote. And now, I'd like to start with something I wrote for my long-deceased newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, Summer Gold Rush. The silly season is in full avarice. Cash registers from coast to coast and amusement parks in between are playing America's song. Our Oregon and Washington beach towns are emporiums of prosperity, their streets and sands swarming with an annual infestation of sun and fun hungry protoplasm. Everybody wants a cut of the tourist buck. Tourism attempts to fill the void left by depleted natural resources, whose exploitation built and sustained the local coastal culture until the forests were cut down and the great fish runs decimated by the impetuous greed of white settlers and their descendants. A magnificent land that had thrived for millennia was ravaged in a century. Now, sultans of fun replace loggers and fisher people. They build shopping centers and malls, condominiums, bigger and glitzier motels, restaurants and bars that remove the remaining trees and block ocean views. Cannon Beach, which in an earlier era resisted opportunities to be a second Carmel, has acquiesced and booms like a gold strike town. Seaside mixed its sand with water and remade its graceful downtown into a cement mall. Astoria hustles its 200 plus years history to lure tourists from the beach towns. Complaints about tourism are usually whines about discourtesies, inconveniences, and crowds of noisy, fussy, impatient strangers. But sometimes criticisms are registered about the sort of environment that is being imposed upon a previously neglected string of coastal towns and the ambivalence of residents between tourist revenues and environmental quality. The current practices of coastal entrepreneurs are a local symptom of a national malady, that money is all that counts, and anything in the way of making a buck deserves to be deep-sixed. Tourism has a habit of destroying what it seeks, and amidst the commercial glitter and singing cash registers, the real gold is slipping out of our hands. Connie Rose Anderson, who used to live in Cannon Beach, and in 1980 wrote an article for the North Coast Times Eagle, A Short History of Seaside, perceived clearly the changes tourism has wrought. She wrote, "Somewhere behind the pavement, the aluminum-framed, junk-filled windows, the traffic, the pinball machines, and snow cone litter lurks the ghost of a pretty little beach town. A town that welcomed progress as a friend, resisted not at all, and in the short span of a person's lifetime, died under its feet with little more than a whimper. Seaside, whatever it is today, is not a pretty little town, either in physical appearance or character. The Oregon coast wears on its shores a string of such pretty little towns: Cannon Beach, Manzanita, Nehalem, all today facing the same forces and models of thinking which have transformed so many of Oregon's coastal gems into a string of tasteless clunkers. Like Godzilla in a greenhouse, the tourist industry is a powerful force plowing through the small town's natural environment, leaving in its wake a trail of highway architecture, parking lots, condominiums, mobile home courts, souvenir junk outlets, and the threat of legalized gambling. And the pretty little town loses more than just its physical beauty to the impersonal wasteland of the commercially controlled tourist trap. It loses its small town energy and character, which are the truest sources of its beauty and grace, and which loss no cosmetic compromise by developers can remedy or replace." And that was revised from the North Coast Times Eagle, July 1986. And Connie Rose Anderson wrote it. And now, the 26th of August, by Leonora Murray. August 26th is not just another summer day. It is the day of remembrance, a special day honoring three generations of American women who successfully campaigned for 72 years and finally won the basic right of citizenship, the right to vote. The 19th Amendment became a part of the United States Constitution on August 26, 1920. After 72 years of struggle, American women finally won their suffrage. One wonders how long it will take to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. Susan B. Anthony went to jail because she attempted to vote. A federal judge told her, "Citizen did not mean women. If we meant women, we would say women," the judge said. So who says we don't need the ERA? I think all of us on the North Oregon coast have feminist ancestors who endured ridicule, derision, distortion, verbal and physical assaults to gain equality. We all have grandmothers, mothers, aunts, sisters, wives, daughters, sweethearts, and cousins, women who got thrown in jail for joining strikes, who got fired when asking for equal wages, who were denied access to training and education on the basis of sex, who marched and demonstrated, who still march and demonstrate. Will you remember them on August 26th? Let's remember our folk heroes, the women who attended the first Equal Rights Conference in New York and published the Seneca Falls Declaration in 1848, the women who joined the Women's Party that Alice Paul founded, the women who were blue-collar workers and union organizers. Let's remember them all with love. Let's celebrate. Let's celebrate the gutsy Dr. Mary Wright, Congressional Medal of Honor winner. She was a battlefield surgeon for the Union Army. 50 years later, Congress decided she had not been brave enough, so they requested the medal be returned. She refused, so Congress denied her military pension. Unfortunately, nobody bothered to take down her exact words, but they must have been dillies to make Congress take such strong action against her. After all, she was still a war veteran entitled to her pension. Let's celebrate ex-slave Sojourner Truth. Her speech, "Ain't I a Woman?" made history when she asked, if women were frail and weak, how come nobody kept her from working as a field hand? And if motherhood and women's sensitivity precluded them from public life, then where was everybody when her 5 children were sold into slavery? Nobody worried about her sensitivity, and "Ain't I a Woman?" She sure was. And in another instance, she faced down a Bible-quoting mob, saying she did indeed believe in Jesus. "But you men have nothing to do with Jesus. That was between God and women. No men anywhere," quote, unquote. A very nice lady, a very tough lady. And let's not forget Sacagawea, pathfinder for Lewis and Clark, or Luch Stone, who made up her own wedding vows and kept her own name. Or Jane Addams, not only a great humanitarian, but first American to win the Nobel Prize, and who insisted that her husband realize that more than just men were equal. Or Elizabeth Cady Stanton, or Abigail Adams, or Oregon's own Agnes Theses Fair, Abigail Scott Dunaway, Dr. Maureen Equi, Julia Rutila, or Amelia Bloomer, who tried so damn hard to make sense out of fashion. Now that lady would be in rat heaven to see jeans as an acceptable garment. I think our libraries need at least one set of American Women of History, her story. Without it, the women I mentioned are just a splash in the ocean. And most of all, let's celebrate the grand old lady, Susan B. Anthony, who said, "Failure is impossible." We believe it. If it takes another 72 years to get women written into the National Constitution and consciousness, we are ready. But I don't think our politicians are. Stanton didn't forget men either. On men's liberation, she said, "Of course, for are not men the children of women?" And most heartening and solemn of all, Susan B. Anthony said, "Until women have the same rights as men on this green earth, there shall never be another season of silence," quote unquote, and amen. Let's all support our local daycare centers. Join the local chapter of the National Organization for Women now. Support our women's crisis centers. And best of all, celebrate our gallant women. August 26th, celebrate the anniversary of women's right to vote. And that was the 26th of August. And Leonora Murray wrote this article to celebrate the 60th anniversary of women's right to vote for the North Coast Times Eagle back in 1980. And now, dying like squirrels. Norman McLean might never have realized how swiftly his posthumously published book, Young Men and Fire, would become useful and perhaps necessary to explain the deaths in early July 1994 of more than a dozen forest firefighters. McLean is more recognized by his very popular book that Robert Redford made into a movie, A River Runs Through It. He was, however, obsessed with a 1949 Montana forest fire that killed 11 smoke jumpers. He spent years researching and tramping over the killing ground of the August 10 Man Gulch fire many, many years ago, and exhaustively interviewed to enduring friendship the survivors who escaped the terrible deaths of their comrades. McLean wrote in Young Men and Fire, "Burning to death on a mountainside is dying at least three times. First, considerably ahead of the fire, you reach the verge of death in your boots and your legs. Next, as you fall, you sink back in the region of strange gases and blue darts where there is no oxygen, and here you die in your lungs. Then you sink in prayer into the main fire that consumes you, and if you are Catholic, about all that remains of you is your cross." And that's a quote from McLean. The men and women who were incinerated in July 1994 while fighting a forest fire in Colorado and in July 2001 in Washington were members of hotshot crews. Being a hotshot in the U.S. Forest Service is equivalent to the hard-ass, perpetually hardship infantry. And though the media claims hotshots are elite firefighting crews, they are probably still treated like the infantry. If any possessed intelligence, none would be either. In the past, at least, hotshots were the dogs of the Forest Service, hardly any more classy than prison crews sent out to fight the same fires. Hotshots battle their enemy with hand weapons, just as dog-faced soldiers, axes, brush hooks, Pulaskis, McLeods, and shovels with which they chop, hack, and scrape trails through the burning wilderness. Wildfire is their enemy, inhuman in contrast to soldiers' nemesis. Sinewy, monstrous, incredibly dangerous and threatening, hot as the sun, grasping for fuel and oxygen to remain alive, sucking human lungs dry at the same instant its intense heat evaporates blood and tissues. Which is what happened to 14 hotshots on a fire in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, working a hotline on a 2-bit tree fire that suddenly exploded into a wind-whipped inferno that trapped 50 firefighters. Most escaped, though barely. 9 of the 14 dead were from an Oregon hotshot crew based in Prineville, 5 men and 4 women. John Kelso, Bonnie Holby, and Terry Hagen from Prineville, Ron Johnson and Doug Dunbar from Redmond, Levi Brinkley from Burns, Kathy Beck from Eugene, Tammy Bickett from Powell Butte, and Scott Buckey from Clatskanie. If it is any consolation, they probably died instantly, consumed as quickly as if a bomb had fallen on them. When each flared like a match, they were already dead from the fire's lung-sucking heat bellows, dehydrated, crisper than potato chips. And that was from something I wrote about hotshots and the fires they fight. I was a hotshot for about 4 seasons in Los Angeles, the Dalton Hotshots, Crew 2. Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is this program's engineer. I am now an Orwellian. This week I have reached the age of 84, and I feel as though I am an unsavory figure in George Orwell's infamously famous book, 1984. I wish now to at least reach 86. As a former bartender, among many other sundry and shady occupations, the number of 86 being ousted out of life has a certain appalling appeal. My birth date is also that of Wilbur Wright and his younger sister, Kate, among others in the Human Almanac.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.